I am Femi Oke. Welcome to the final bonus edition of the stream for 2021. Next week, Mark Lamont here will be in this time slot with a new series of Upfront. It's going to be good. Be sure to watch. First, I'm going to share one last time with you some of the best behind-the-scenes conversations that I have with stream guests after the live show airs. Coming up, Nigerians who are determined to reform a police force that is so violent, sometimes you can't tell the difference between police and criminals. And we challenge a guest to answer your wide-ranging questions on Myanmar. We begin with singer-songwriter Mumu Fresh, who memorably sang on the stream a few years ago. Her talents stretch way beyond performing. We caught up on Instagram recently to talk about the work she does when she's not singing.
I've done workshops throughout prisons in the West Coast. Mm-hmm. We've done maximum security prisons for women. I've done workshops just for Muslim women who are artists, who are, you know, trying to find their voice. Especially in some of the circles that are a little more anti-music. So, you know, but it's really important because music is such a therapeutic device, and it absolutely can be halal. It doesn't have to be haram, you know? And so I think it's really important that that we find our voice in a way that is very spiritual, and it does uplift God, and it does uplift righteousness. I think that's important to keep in mind. I just recently did one for a methadone clinic that was really, really powerful, especially because nobody in there, they weren't writers previously, you know, but they still came up with really amazing pieces. So like music and writing doesn't have to be exclusive to people who consider themselves artists for a living. You know, it's really about tapping into your narrative inside and getting acquainted with, you know, we always have a storyteller inside, right? So your subconscious is always telling you a narrative. So it's getting in contact with that person and kind of aligning those subconscious and conscious stories to make sure that it's the story that we want to tell, to make sure it's the truth about ourselves, and to make sure like we are projecting into the future what we really want and not just what we have been taught to believe we can have.
One of the things that you mentioned to me was about mothers are artists and creators as well.
Yeah.
Tell us about that more personal side of your life.
Well, I am a mother, and I've had my son on tour with me almost all of his life. So I definitely, I know that journey. It's been a beautiful one. It's been a difficult one. And a lot of mothers reach out to me all the time asking me, how did you do it? How, you know, because I had to homeschool my son because we're on tour. And not just because we're on tour, also because I felt like I could give him a better education. There's a term we use now called unschooling. When I was a kid, my mom homeschooled me too. We didn't use that term. But unschooling is basically experiential learning. So if I have a tour date in a particular city, and I know there are certain famous museums or other landmarks that I want him to know about, I'll kind of base his curriculum around the places that we're going to go and things that he can learn while we're there. And it's very different from classroom learning, but I think it's actually really, really effective. And it also draws you closer to your child. I think when I was first taking my son, people kind of felt like, this is neglect. Why is there a child here? And for me, I feel like, why is music not a family experience? Why can he not be here? Like, I don't do the type of music that I have to hide from my kid. So, you know, it was important for me that he be a part of my journey, that he knows what I do for a living, and that he's a part of it. He helps me with my merchandise on tour. Like, now I just give him all the merchandise. Like, okay, set up the stuff, you know, you got the swipe, you know, so he handles all of that. And it's been a really great experience for him. I love hearing him talk to other people about, like, what does your mom do for a living? And, you know, so you were on tour? Wait, really? And he's been all over the world. You know, we've been on cruise ships working together. And so I guess I have a very special place in my heart, especially for artist mothers. My mother's also artist mother. My grandmother was an artist mother. And how difficult it can be. Times have changed a lot, I think, and have created more space for artist mothers to exist. But I think there was definitely a time where I've at least had people say to me, like, you're still doing music even after being a mother? You don't think that's irresponsible? And I say, no, I think it's irresponsible for me to hide my light and snuff out my gift when that's what God called me to do. You know, how can you tell your kids to follow their dreams if we're afraid to follow ours? So no, I'm going to follow my dreams and raise my kids.
Maimuna Youssef, also known as Mumu Fresh, on the Stream's Instagram Live series. Maimuna will be back to perform at the end of the show. As the most anticipated climate conference for years is about to get underway in Glasgow, activists on the lookout for meaningful climate action are not greenwashing. In a recent conversation on the Stream, Ahmed Shahbaldin and his guests unpacked some of the most egregious examples of this. Ahmed got the conversation started with Jenny Condit from Extinction Rebellion.
As far as advertising is concerned, they spend a lot of their ill-gotten cash on misleading ads, and they also spend money on greenwashing. I think we shouldn't allow them to be doing either. Here's a new greenwashing story, by the way. Just yesterday, the Science Museum in London announced that they are going to be sponsored in their next climate exhibition by a company called Adani. So that's Adani's shiny object. What else are they doing at the same time? They're trying to open the largest ever coal mine in Australia. That's greenwashing, and we should not allow it.
Jeffrey, I know you were pretty outraged by that, or at least surprised that it's so blatant. What do you make of her comments there about what's actually happening with Adani? And why would these things be happening? Why is the Science Museum doing this?
Yeah, it's greenwashing 101. And yeah, to be honest, I wasn't surprised. I actually called this, that in the, you know, the run up to the UN climate talks in the UK this month, next month, that we would see, you know, fossil fuel companies trying to position themselves, especially in the UK or Europe, as, you know, more green than they really are. For context, Adani, they're a, you know, massive coal company in India. They have a renewables offshoot that is technically the sponsor of this forthcoming environment exhibit. But they joined Shell, which is currently sponsoring also a climate exhibit at the same museum. And so, to be really honest, and it saddens me as actually, you know, someone from the UK, I grew up loving the London Science Museum. The museum has really lost its way, and it has frankly become captured and is now a vehicle for fossil fuel industry greenwashing.
Mm-hmm. I know that earlier this year, Amsterdam, Sylvie, imposed a ban in the city's metro network on ads linked to what they call fossil products. They said that, you know, gas-powered cars, also cheap airline tickets, and this is, you know, the municipality saying just a first step in a series of steps. What would you like to see, and what do you believe will need to happen in order to gain the kind of momentum to not only hold these companies to account and call them out on the greenwashing, but to actually, you know, address the climate crisis?
Well, momentum is exactly what we see around across Europe. You mentioned Amsterdam. This is something similar has just happened in the Hague, and there's more and more conversations in different European cities around this. There's the new French climate law that also has the first steps towards a ban of this kind, even if it doesn't go as far as civil society in France would have wanted. And we were just talking about measures that are radical, but considering the state of the planet, these measures are just appropriate. And you know, we're just discussing how long these companies have known about the effects of their business, and how effectively and consistently they have been delaying climate action, meaningful climate action.
Right.
I don't think that a ban of this kind is radical at all. It's just appropriate that these companies have not demonstrated that they have the interest of people and the planet at
right, right.
At the core.
And on that point, Jeffrey, I know we touched on it earlier in the live show, but is it realistic that we will see that in your mind? Is there momentum around what's happening here in the U.S. and Congress, these other initiatives in The Hague and Amsterdam and elsewhere? Do you think we're at a turning point? Do you think that there will be more pressure put on their ability to keep spinning this story?
For sure. The entire decade that I've been working on climate change, we have seen this building momentum. And unfortunately, change usually comes slowly. But, you know, my research and others, illustrates really close parallels between the propaganda techniques of Big Tobacco and Big Oil. Big Oil is, frankly, the new Big Tobacco. Mm-hmm. And so learning from that history, it seems almost inevitable. There is such overwhelming historical evidence now, you know, documented and piling up, of the malfeasance of this oil and gas industry. And so, yeah, to me, it does seem there's an inevitability that accountability will come. The only question is, does it come soon enough to matter the most? Because unfortunately, unlike most problems, global warming is essentially irreversible on an meaningful timing scale. Mm-hmm. So it's now or never, and hopefully it's now.
Yeah.
That's the reason why initiatives like such a European-wide ban would be really important in terms especially of time, because of the state of the crisis we're in at the moment. Of course, we don't. Time is a luxury that we cannot afford anymore. Mm-hmm. And all these initiatives happening at individual level in different cities are all very good, or also like individual actions against companies, advertisement by different civil society organizations. There have been a few who have been, a few organizations who have taken companies to court over their advertisement. But these things are very lengthy processes. They require a lot of resources and time. And we simply don't have that time anymore.
You know, our research and others have shown that the fossil fuel industry has been on notice for more than half a century, almost twice my lifetime, about the fact that its products could cause dangerous global warming. And yet, instead of warning the public or taking action, they stayed silent for as long as they could. And when that was no longer an option, they came out swinging with, you know, a multi-decade, multi-million dollar disinformation and denial campaign. Mm-hmm. And what we're talking about today with the greenwashing is the 21st century evolution of that tactic. Literally what one Exxon manager called an effort by the company to reset its profile in a way that basically would be more defensible, you know, as the public and policymakers woke up to the climate crisis. So it's very much a continuation from denial to delay with the same end goal, which is always to stop action on climate change.
Scientist and activist Jeffrey Supran. Thanks, Jeffrey. Last year, mass protests in Nigeria forced the government to shut down a notoriously violent police unit. One year later, many Nigerian citizens are still terrified of the police. In a post-show discussion, the guests explain why.
In Nigeria, the police we have is one who do not have any understanding or any human feeling. I think when people join the police force in Nigeria, they lose their sense of humanity. And I say this because I'm a direct survivor of police brutality of the highest order. In 2012, my brother was arrested by the SARS in Anambra State. The OC in charge, James Nwafor, told my parents that he had killed my brother and there was nothing they could do about it. And up till now, nothing has been done about it. At the height of End-SARS protest, he was the SSA to the Anambra State governor on security, and he was sacked by the Anambra State government, and we were assured that he will be probed and prosecuted, right? It's been 1 year. He is working freely in Anambra State with police as escorts. Nothing has been done about it. I assure you, the Nigerian police system is designed to be horrible. There are no way around it. There's no way to say, well, these are some people that are bad. No. In the Nigerian police system, what we have is a designed plot to ensure that people are exploited, killed, sexually violated at all times and without fear. Because to deny someone access to the child and then tell him to his face that you have killed the child and there was nothing they can do about it is the highest form of, I don't know, what word, degradation. My dad was totally humiliated. To think that this man begged you, knelt down and begged for his son's life, and you tell him to his face that there was nothing that he can do, that you have killed his son, and you get away with it. And the Nigerian government, even after all my clamoring, even after all the agitation during the End-SARS protest, nothing has changed. Nothing has happened. It tells you, it speaks to you that the Nigerian government is in support of what is happening. But more importantly, the Nigerian police needs to be totally overhauled, because you have people who have lost their sense of humanity in that system. There is no redemption for them at all. None.
Fasaya.
Okay. Two quick examples. One was that in 2017, I closed from office around Wuse 2 in Abuja, past 11. I saw SAS officials in front from afar. I turned back and I had to use a longer route. A lot of Nigerians are afraid of the police of SAS. You see SAS, you think harm, danger, and you run back. Now, after the end SAS protest, just about 4 months ago, this year, I closed from work around past 1 a.m. I ran into police. And they were banging the door of my car. Ba, 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 ba. Open this door. Ba, 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 ba. And I opened. I showed them my press ID. And the next thing the guy said, he said it in Pidgin, but I'll translate. He said, as you run into us, if you just give us 20,000 naira, it's not too much. And so they're just like armed robbers in uniforms. Just like Obianodu said, after all the noise he has made, nothing has happened. It is because the guys who should make the reforms also benefited from the system, also have skeletons in their cupboard. They can't discipline that Anambra guy because if they did, their own cupboards of skeletons would have been opened. And that's why we have this mess.
Rene.
So, Fisaya and Obianiju have said a lot. I think I would start from the fact that I am 22 years old, and I come from a country where there is little to no regard for human lives. People are dying due to causes that can be prevented by the accountability and good governance from our political leaders. 16-year-old Tina Ezekwe was shot on the evening of the 26th of May by a drunk SARS officer. She died 2 days later. She was supposed to write her school leaving exams few days after she was killed. Her parents were left in a position with no access to justice or help. It took the push and the collective action of justice and reform activists to get anything done. That wouldn't have happened if it were the child, it was the child of one of our politicians or the elites. The common man in Nigeria so far, just because they are common, regarded as nobody. And young people in my country have always ended up becoming victims of the failed system where there is no access to justice, jobs, or good health care. Being a Nigerian means you have to always fight against unseen forces. But more importantly, fight not to die. Why? Because the government, who is supposed to protect the lives and properties, are missing in action. They are busy stealing and benefiting from the indignity of average Nigerians. We organized one of the largest peaceful movement, youth movement worldwide, alongside millions of young Nigerians. And it felt like the fault lines were shifting. It felt like our voices would be respected. Nigerians became proud to be Nigerians again. In the faces of many young people across protest grounds, hope came alive. We were nearly killed as well by the police outside the State House of Assembly in the middle of the night on the 8th of October, and this sparked widespread protests across the country and beyond. And if the protests remained largely peaceful, it is important to say this, until the Nigerian government decided to hijack the movement through sponsored hoodlums and later ordered military operatives to shoot at protesters. We pushed for justice and reform as young people, because this is about our future. Like Fisaya said, it's about survival. It's about not becoming a victim tomorrow. And the biggest issues regarding policing reforms is that the Nigerian political elite has not shown the political will to take concrete steps that would cause its members their impunity and subject them to accountability. What I mean is that our lawmakers are the lawbreakers. How do we now expect those that should hold the law not to also join in abusing fundamental human rights and the law? Nigerian citizens and young people have a voice, and they have a right to demand that Nigeria works for all of them, not just for the children of politicians. Nigerians has to work. Nigeria has to work for everybody. Thank you.
You can watch the full episode looking at Nigeria a year after the end SARS protests at stream.aljazeera.com. Finally, we head to Myanmar, now in its ninth month of being ruled by a military junta. Wei Nin is from the Burma Campaign UK. She joined the stream with an update and then stayed after the show to answer viewers' questions. Carl Marston, for instance, wanted to know if Myanmar is a failed state.
Have a legitimate government that people have voted for, and they are still People still want them to be back in power. And also all these resistant movements and all these ethnic armed organizations and ethnic advocacy groups on the ground, they are very organized. They are very strategic, more than the Burmese military. The Burmese military is the one who is bringing instability to the country. They're the one committing human rights abuses and atrocities for many decades. And of course, the situation gets worse and worse since they staged the coup on 1st of February. So I would like to say that Burma is not a failed state yet, mm-hmm. And also it's the international community, it's their duty to stop Burma from becoming a failed state. And, you know, there are so many things they can do. And it's sometimes so frustrating that they're not doing enough to help people on the ground.
This one is from Andrew Ryan. Andrew wanted to know, was Myanmar ever successful?
Yes, that's one of the questions I get a lot. They always comment or say, oh, how sad to see Burma falling down from democracy. But so I have to correct them and say, Burma never had democracy. Even in the past 10 years during the reform process, yes, in the city areas, there were some relative reforms and some high-profile political prisoners being released. But in ethnic area, there was a civil wars going on. Military continue attacking ethnic civilians. And so many people are still living in internally displaced camps from 10 years ago. And genocide of the Rohingya happened in 2017. And civilians and activists being arrested for speaking out against the military or even the civilian government in the past 5 years. So I would always correct people and say Burma never had true democracy, genuine democracy. Military always has control of the whole country. They are the one with the true power in the country, even during the reform years.
Wei Nin, I've heard you and other activists and pro-democracy activists really ask the international community to do more. So this question for Hermes fits right into that area. Do any foreign powers have an interest in maintaining the current military rule? Is anyone doing business, working with, collaborating with Myanmar right now that you know about?
There are companies, foreign companies, working with the Burmese military. So we are trying to identify them and stop them. And we are encouraging governments like the British government and the US government to approach these companies and tell them to stop working with the Burmese military. For the US, one of the main companies is Chevron. And it go back to sanctions on oil and gas revenues for Burmese military. Because this is the biggest source of income, and Chevron and Total in France, they're the two main companies investing in the country. So we need to stop those revenues flow because it will hurt the military a lot because they care about money, they care about their financial security. So this is very important strategy to hit them hard.
Mm-hmm. One last question. This one comes from Femi in Washington, D.C. What is the biggest misconception when you talk to people, you talk about your work, they understand what you do? What do they not understand about Myanmar and its current circumstances?
I think the situation in the country, we don't really see that a lot in international media anymore. So when I see people or when I meet new friends, they say, oh, maybe military has the power now. Military won. But I have to tell them, no, military still hasn't won, despite the fact that they've been arresting people, they've been killing people and attacking ethnic civilians. But they haven't won yet because the resistance in the country is growing every day. People are protesting in different forms, in a flash mob or a very creative way. People, because we are very determined that this is our last fight. We don't want to live under the military dictatorship, and we are ready to do whatever it takes to uproot the military. And people from inside and outside the country are working tirelessly to make this happen so we get democracy and freedom in the country, and we need international support.
And that's our show for today. We end the bonus edition series, as we began, with the gorgeous voice of Mumu Fresh performing on the stream. Thanks for watching.
Stand with me, please, please, please don't forget about me. Oh, say my name. Oh, say my name. Don't let it be in vain. Oh, say my name. Oh, say my name.
eventually die.